It's time to think big with Big Alaska Guests, Big Alaska Adventures, and no good lying through your tooth, Tall Alaska Tales. It's the Big Alaska Show. Broadcasting from the studios of a remote cabin outside Bolchitna and streamed worldwide at KFQD.com with podcast streamed to BigAlaskaShow.com. I'm Mike Ford with Uncle Stevenson, Big Alaska Show friends. It's a Fur-Rondi Iditarod convergence. The Fur-Rondi ends and dovetails into the Iditarod ceremonial start, featuring the very first Iditarod with Rod Perry. And we honor the winner of the highly coveted second annual Outhouse Race Big Alaska Show Fur Trapper Crapper Award. Plus, we have a Tall Alaska Tale, designed to raise your spirits, not your blood pressure, unless you're a guy named Mike Ford. Good morning, everyone. It's the Big Alaska Show.
And good morning and welcome to the Big Alaska Show. Uncle Steve here along with my good buddy and co-host Mike Ford. Now normally at this point, Mike and I do what we call our witty banter. That's where we catch up with each other, talk about the day's show and the guests. But the good news for you is our witty banter is going to be short because we have a full show. We have, as Mike says, convergence, where the Fur-Rondi ends and dovetails into the Iditarod ceremonial start. So today's show is filled with stuff from each. Hey, first, a big shout out to the Iditarod Nation and mushers for adjusting to the conditions of no snow. And although the ceremonial start is a little shorter than normal, they're pulling it off. And then to boot, they got to go to Fairbanks for the restart. And this is the perfect example of the Iditarod spirit that celebrates the 1925 serum run when people joined together to overcome seemingly impossible odds to save Nome from a diphtheria outbreak. And so our guest is Rod Perry, who was in the first Iditarod 1973, and although a different time, shows that same spirit. And then last Saturday, the Big Alaska Show reached a major milestone by awarding the last place team in the Outhouse Race our highly coveted second annual Big Alaska Show Fur Trapper Crapper Award. And Mike put together a great report on that momentous occasion. Plus, he chatted with Bob Maxwell, who puts the thing on. And plus, we got a Tall Alaska Tale. So we got a packed show, folks. But of course, we'd be remiss if we didn't start the Big Alaska Show out the right way.
Folks, the key to doing an early morning radio show, especially a Saturday morning radio show, is a strong cup of coffee. And there's no stronger cup of Joe than Big Alaska Show Blend. The intense early morning coffee for intense early morning indigestion. That's why it's the preferred coffee for Iditarod mushers. It takes a lot of work to run the Iditarod, and mushers go for days with very little sleep. But just one sip of caffeine-packed Big Alaska Show blend, and mushers won't get any sleep and only need one dog. And one taste says it all. Bitter biting with a specific gravity of basalt. Big Alaska Show Blend, the intense early morning coffee for intense early morning gas.
Pour me a cup, it's time to get up and face the world, my friend. Pour me a cup, I can't get enough of that Big Alaska Show Blend.
And that's how we roll here at the Big Alaska Show. But stick around, we have more Big Alaska Show coming up. And you can hear our show streamed and get podcast at BigAlaskaShow.com.
And welcome back to the Big Alaska Show. I'm Mike Ford with Uncle Steve. Our show brought to you in part by Neighbors Windows and Doors. They're Alaska's window experts for windows, doors, shower doors, affordable glass replacement. Neighbors Windows and Doors at 6251 Tunnel or online anytime at neighborswindowsanddoors.com.
And thanks for joining us on this Fur Rondi Iditarod show. Last Saturday, Mike covered the popular Fur Rondi outhouse races. He was joined by our good buddy David Goldman from KYES 5 and Channel 2, the NBC affiliate, and their job was to identify and present the last place outhouse team, the highly coveted second annual Big Alaska Show Fur Trapper Crapper Award. But first, Mike visited with a guy that oversees this whole thing.
Outhouse races, next to the World Championship sled dog races and the running of the reindeer, it's safe to say this event draws one of the bigger crowds with the Fur Rendezvous folks. Nearly 2,000 people were sighted at last year's crowd. I wanted to find out what was going on, so I reached out to the man in charge. Bob Maxwell was running the show this year. Bob, how'd you get involved with the outhouse races?
Well, I was the faculty advisor for the Architecture and Engineering Club at UAA. Fur Rondi had the outhouse races, but then there was a large gap where no one was doing them anymore. So we asked them, we petitioned them to allow us to be an event in there. And we traveled every year. We did. We worked with Habitat for Humanity.
Okay.
And we went all. We went to New Orleans 9 times. We went to Miami a couple times. And Arrow Beach a couple times, and Houston, and Charleston, South Carolina. And we went there and built homes with Habitat for Humanity. These are architecture and engineering students, and so they got a little hands-on experience. And with COVID, I left the university and at that point stopped fundraising for a club that no longer existed. And I had been active with the Three Barons Fair long before that, and so that seemed like a natural fit. Do a fundraiser and direct the funds towards them.
This is the most exciting part is about yet to happen to your race because the Big Alaska Show. I can't even remember who we gave it to last year. It was the inaugural version of the Fur Trapper Crapper Award, which is a bedazzled toilet seat, and it hasn't been sat upon by Lord Trapper, but it has been approved. You didn't know we were going to be adding that to this weekend's fund, did you?
No, did not know that. It's great.
Perhaps next year we can make it to the podium table, but I don't know if then we'd have to be sanctioned. We like to fly under the radar here at the Big Alaska Show, being Alaska's longest running mistake ridden radio broadcast. You know, we kind of like to do our own thing.
Nice.
What should we be expecting now when we come down there? How many entries do you have for this year's race?
This year we have 22.
22. That's a lot of people pushing outhouses around, Bob.
Each team is a team of 10. So you do the math.
Okay. No, that's not my strong point. Never mind.
Over 200 people.
And I'm sure there are requirements for each of these teams as far as specifications of these outhouses and what they have to have adorned on them. Is that correct?
Yes. Well, we have two divisions. We have the traditional division, which is outhouses that are built on a 30-by-30 base and look like an outhouse that you would find out in the bush. And then we have the unlimited class, and those are anything on skis. I've seen shopping carts. I've seen water barrels. They put skis on just about anything. The idea is to keep it light and so that it can be fast.
Okay, and who won last year's event?
Kewett. Kewett's won the last 6 times.
What do they owe their success to in your mind?
I would say that they have figured out the design element of what tracks the best in the snow and what corners the best. And the race is won and lost as they go around the pylon.
Uh-huh.
And Kewett has a special. No one else has done it. They have a snowboard that they ride on for the most part, and they have 2 skis on outriggers. And as soon as they lean their sled one way or the other, that outrigger grabs and turns it.
Oh.
And so they've got the design down. And no one's been able to, they have been beat once, but they came back through the loser's bracket and took the whole thing.
Wow. You would think that people would catch on to their strategy.
You would, but it's a wonky setup. It tips one way or the other real easy. So there is some skill involved with keeping it up on the one ski during the straightaways.
Okay, well, that's good to know. And maybe they'll get some insight for next year. By the time we broadcast this, it'll be too late to utilize the strategy. But that's nice to know. That's good. And it'll happen whether there's snow or no snow, because not much snow out there this year, is there, Bob?
No. There's snow somewhere because they'll bring it in.
Okay. We got to love our crew down there helping get in the snow for the dog races and for the outhouse races and for all the good stuff. The fat bike race will be a big thing, too, I'm sure. So we look forward to seeing you downtown, and that's between E and F, right?
Yep, on 4th Avenue.
On 4th Avenue, and we'll be sure to get back with you and let you know who the winner of the Fur Trapper Crapper Award is, Bob, and we hope to see you and maybe even become a bigger part of next year's opportunity.
Excellent.
And now we join Mike Ford and David Goldman in search of the last place outhouse race team.
With all the information we thought we needed, Dave Goldman and I headed downtown to hand out the Fur Trapper Crapper Award.
So, Dave, this is your first time being involved with the Alaska Fur Trapper Crapper Award ceremony. How do you feel?
It's a full circle weekend, Mike. When I got up here 12 years ago and had the chance to do the Iditarod and all the sled dog races, and now finally the Fur Rondi joining you and Jeremy, and now... Now I can say the career is complete because we've arrived. This is Broadway. This is where you strive to be.
Yes.
And I feel like I've finally gotten here now.
Yes.
It's taken a long time.
Yes.
But we're gonna make it. And we might even stand instead of sit.
Okay. Sounds good. All right. And well, let's go pick a winner, Dave.
Indeed. Somebody out there is gonna walk home with a coveted prize today.
No, Dave, they don't get the prize. It's just a plaque that's going to go on the prize. We're hanging on. Last year, we gave away the prize.
Oof.
We didn't have a budget.
They may be upset about this with the work, you know.
That's okay.
They've been working all year for this.
They'll get over it.
Okay.
All right. Let's go find a winner.
All right.
After viewing a number of amazing outhouses from teams such as Active Duty, Team Jesus, and the Turd Trotters, we finally saw the winner just ahead. Made with just enough materials, mostly cardboard, to make it around the course the minimum of 2 times, barely. A team comprised of Air Force intelligence operators whose names were not allowed to share and whose images were obscured by fantastic costumes. Congratulations to the Ass Blasters! Rondi board member Beth and Lord Trapper Bill doing the honors of handing out the coveted award.
It is with great pleasure in representing Greater Anchorage, Inc. and the Fur Rendezvous Festival, which is, I will add, North America's number one winter festival.
90 years old.
You, the Ass Blasters, have been bestowed, and it is my great honor to award you with, and Lord Trapper, can you please do the honors?
I can. As Lord Trapper, I would like to give you the Trapper Crapper Award.
Woo!
Congratulations, Ass Blaster! Remember, Woo! Lit up!
Okay, now the deal is, though, you don't really get the thing. We're just going to send you a letter.
Yeah, we'll
send
a picture.
Okay, we'll take it.
Can we
take a picture with
you? Absolutely. It's beautiful, and it comes in two parts. It looks like
you can share the
really,
award.
Dress up their outhouse.
Hey, it's not supposed to be in two parts. What happened?
It looks a lot like, well, your operation here. Yeah. You want to hold it?
Team Captain.
Overtaken by joy, the Ass Blasters knew there was only one radio show in Alaska that could give them such an amazing award.
The Big Alaska Show!
Rondi!
and welcome back to the Big Alaska Show. I'm Mike Ford with Uncle Steve. Our show brought to you in part by Neighbors Windows and Doors. They're Alaska's window experts for windows, doors, shower doors, affordable glass replacement. Neighbors Windows and Doors at 6251 Tunnel or online anytime at neighborswindowsanddoors.com.
And welcome back to the Big Alaska Show. Uncle Steve here along with my good buddy and co-host Mike Ford. This year's Iditarod ceremonial starts, launches a whole new era of young mushers, but also stirs up a lot of Iditarod memories as we go back in time to the very first Iditarod 1973.
Mitch Seavey's record-setting pace for the Iditarod, a sharp contrast to the results of the first Iditarod race that took place in 1973. I did have a chance to sit down with Rod Perry. He was in the first race. With Mitch Seavey's father, Dan. And as you'll hear, the comparisons between today's Iditarod and the one in 1973, well, they couldn't be more different.
I did the Iditarod trail.
The first Iditarod was, well, let me just say this. Frank Gerjevic and I were talking. He's a well-known writer with the Dispatch, long time with the Daily News. He was saying, you know, Rod, people just don't understand. They think that the Iditarod just kind of arrived fully formed, pretty much the way you see it today, but just a little bit more primitive. I'm here to tell you that it was about as different as the Lewis and Clark expedition was from a race over the interstate from St. Louis to Astoria by Ferrari today. About the only similarities is we had animals out in front of a conveyance being pulled, and there was some guy riding the sled. Other than that, not much of a similarity. I get the idea, talking with people, even people that go back a long ways but not far enough, that they consider that first Iditarod was a distinction without a difference. And when they voice that, I often just think to myself, you weren't there. When I see somebody write about that first Iditarod, or talk about it, or try to film it, three words come to me. They weren't there. They miss all the good talking points. They wouldn't know them. Very shallow coverage. When the building is erected and the forms come off, the scaffold comes down, people that come a day later can't visualize it as it was during construction. When the first Iditarod was suggested and the word started to get out there, it seemed too audacious, too grandiose. It sounded absurd. Always before, it had been short dashes around towns and villages over manicured trails. That was the accepted race model. You get out of your bed at home and eat breakfast, go to the track, run, or maybe go down to the, you know, for the fur rendezvous race and spend all day, but you go home at night and sleep in your own bed and take care of your own logistics. And this thing, holy smoke, it just sounded too absurd to ever be able to bring off. Nobody could be convinced, couldn't raise adequate funding. There is more funding behind a single team, the least funded team of today, than we had to fund the entire Iditarod race. Every musher in it, every team, all the sponsorships wouldn't equal one person's outfit today. It was determined, though, hey, it was a broke-but-go-anyway deal. We had one chance and one chance only to found it. It was the year that General Geddes was head of Fort Rich and Elmendorf. Those generals would trade off. Each had a general over it, but one would be head over all of it one year. The other one the next year. Well, it was the last year General Geddes was here, and he was a dog-driving nut. He loved driving dogs. He'd often go out to Dick Tozier's. Tozier would have a little team waiting for him. And General Geddes would drive around out on Campbell Airstrip and kind of wash his mind from the pressures of running the military bases here. But he cooked up a plan to, quote, this is fairly close anyway. I say quote, meaning this is approximate. Test the use of snow machines for their reliability in long-range Arctic warfare. Actually, he was just breaking trail for his buddy Joe Reddington so he could run a race to Nome. So without the military doing that, we couldn't have done it. If you think of the tremendous expense of what they had to go to be able to make it through. There was no visible trail. They tried as hard as they could to spot it from the air. They spent thousands of hours in the air. If a machine would do just a little more than cough, you know, those guys would fix a belt or they'd fix a, replace a plug, anything else. They just lift it up by helicopter, carry it, you know, as the trail went on, and it, sometimes hundreds of miles back to the shop here on base and fix it and fly new steel out to them. We could have never done that. And it really fit because the Iditarod Trail was built in 1910-11 by the Alaska Road Commission, which was a division of the U.S. Army. So really, it was it just fit perfectly. We had to do it that year or no year. You think about it. You're trying to patch this race together with no money. You've never done it before. But there's some conjecture and some pretty clear thinking, good guesses as to what you're going to need out there. How are you going to bring this thing off? So, you know, you're going to need some checkpoints. You're going to need some people out there manning the checkpoints. And maybe you can get the ham radio people to, you know, provide a little bit of communication. And you think of all these different things. But if you don't have any money at all, you have to leave a good share of them out. So who do you want on the trail? Do you want an insurance salesman from Cincinnati that just took up dog mushing 5 years ago and now is placing in the top 10? Or do you want old Bobby Vent, who probably, you know, he's chief of his village up north of the Arctic Circle, Huslia. He'd load his sled each October with gear and supplies, plan his own route. All of his own logistics were his own, of his own making. Head deep into the Arctic on his trap line. Maybe come back in around Christmas time, bring his furs in, resupply, spend the holidays with his family, and then back out. They wouldn't see him again until the end of beaver season in April. This is the kind of person that we needed out there, and that's the very type that showed up for the race.
I did the right trail.
You're listening to an interview with Rod Perry about the first Iditarod in 1973, and now part two with our interview with Rod Perry.
We're continuing our interview we had with Rod Perry. He was on the very first Iditarod in 1973.
I did the Iditarod trail.
Now, the first two races, we went all the way from Anchorage to Nome by dog team. We did not have any kind of interruption, no vehicular pickup to move to another start on the first two races. So to get across over into the hay flats, they shut down traffic across the Kinnick River Bridge, and we crossed there and then headed on to Kinnick. If you did not make it into Kinnick in 24 hours of the start, you were culled from the race. So most of the drivers didn't have any trouble doing that. They have to qualify drivers today. I don't know who would have qualified the early guys. How are you going to qualify a George Atler or an Isaac Oklesic, the born on the runners? As we came into Kinnick, most of the guys stayed the night. The next day, it was quite a scene. The teams would lope the length of Kinnick Lake, climb up the little hill off the end of the lake, disappear into the birch forest. It was pretty amazing to watch two women crying there. One stood silently just gazing at where the drivers had disappeared. And it must have seemed to her like all wild Alaska was devouring the man, just crouched there, cruel and merciless with jaws open. And devouring team after team. She stood there very silently weeping, tears dribbling down the front of her parka. Another lady was being consoled by two or three others being held in their arms, and she was sobbing. they thought that the chances were good. They would never see their husbands again alive. That's how into the unknown it was. Today, over 800 different people have run the race. Some of them know that trail like you and I know our way back and forth to work. It has been done and done and done. Thousands upon thousands of passages over that trail. Back then, there had been none. We just didn't know. One guy that didn't know was Bud Smith. He broke his sled on the way to Kinnick. He thought, holy smoke, who knows what is going to be out there. He went home, he took his dog team, left the race, went home to Houston to his homestead, and enlisted the help of his family. They worked round the clock. He built a dog sled, and he got back in the race. That sled still exists today. It was built out of oak timbers the size of 2x4s for stanchions. The runners were 4 inches wide and about 2 inches thick. I had to laminate them to turn them up in the front. At the end, the sled weighed 220 pounds. I helped him get it down off the bench in McGrath after he put new shoeing on the runners. I mean, who'd have ever heard of such a thing? Somebody pulling out of the race and going home for a day and coming back. And he ended up placing 12th. Quite a deal.
I did the right trail.
Hi, this is Uncle Steve for the Big Alaska Show. On behalf of co-host Mike Ford and me, we'd like to thank you for taking time to listen to our commercial-free podcast. That's right. Other than the billboards at the beginning of each segment that say, brought to you by Neighbors Windows and Doors, Alaska's window experts, from purchase to window installation, visit Alaska's Best, Neighbors Windows and Doors, 6251 Tuttle, or visit neighborswindowsanddoors.com, but other than that, completely commercial-free. Besides, our Big Alaska Show listeners are discerning, smart people. We know where they'd go if they had any need whatsoever for, let's say, windows, doors, shower doors, or glass. Nope. Commercial free, we say. Because our listeners deserve respect. To do anything less would be the workings of flawed, desperate men of character who will do anything for a buck. And thanks for joining us for our commercial free special Iditarod edition of the Big Alaska Show.
The race, as you might imagine, was really, really disorganized. I mean, it was organized just barely enough to hang together, my dad said, only by bubblegum and bobby pins. When Dick Wilmarth came to the first checkpoint and looked for his food, there was nothing there. And luckily, Dick was a really, really savvy bush traveler, like most of the guys were. He thought, well, he had started out with quite a lot on his sled, just in case. So he fed that. He got a little help from Joe Dealey out in Squintna. Joe had some salmon backbones left over from cutting fish in the summer, gave them to Dick, and the dogs gobbled them right up. But boy, they just plugged his dogs up in the end. He gets to the next place, no food. By the way, on the first race, there was only a food drop every other checkpoint and a dog drop every other checkpoint. Couldn't drop dogs at every checkpoint. So when they finally reached the Happy River and Dick had not found one single drop, he was getting into a dire situation. The other guy stopped for the night, and had Dick only known what some of the Eskimos were going to find, he would have stopped too. They found a winter-killed moose, built a big bonfire almost on top of it, thawed it out enough. They sat around chopping moose meat off for their dogs all night because they'd already gotten a hint that things might not be quite so well organized ahead. So Wilmarth takes off. He's a bush pilot. He's a gold miner from Red Devil and had run a trap line a number of years before. Moxie guy. Great on the snowshoes. So he knows the lay of the land. Through the darkness he goes, snowshoeing through the night. In the wee hours of the morning, still pitch black, he gets to Puntilla Lake, looks across the lake, sees the oldest hunting lodge in Alaska, Rennie Pass Lodge. He snowshoes up to the door. Now, back then, nobody ever went that far by snowmobile. It just, not even close to it. And once in a great while, a pilot would land there. So here's Al and Ann Budzinski, my friends that were caretaking the lodge. they are sound asleep in the cabin. And from out of nowhere comes a pounding on the door. Knock, knock, knock. Well, holy smoke. They haven't heard an airplane engine, nothing. In the ambient light, dim light of the cabin, they are up on their elbows looking at each other with their hands, palms in the air, like, what? And Al calls out, hello, who's there? May we help you? And he's sliding his feet out, getting them into his slippers, shuffling toward the door, and the cry comes back. It's Wilmarth. Is the food here? And all Al can think is there's been a downed pilot that's managed to snowshoe his way in, and he's starving. Opens the door. Mr. Wilmarth, he said, come on in. If you're hungry, we've got lots of food. And Dick says, no, 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 the dog food for the Iditarod. And Al says, what? Are they going to hold that? And people wonder why it took 20 days. Okay, so team after team started coming in the morning. There was no food at all and no drop at Rainy Pass. If you think about it, you're trying to plan this race. You're sitting out around the homestead or somewhere and conjecturing and trying to figure out what you're going to need. Where are you going to want the greatest drop on the entire race? Nobody's been through the Alaska Range that you can talk to. All you can think of is the view up toward Mount McKinley, Mount in that day, and Mount Denali today. You don't know what it's going to be like. How many days are you going to have to go through glacier? I mean, what? And so you plan your biggest drop there, and there's nothing. So Wilmarth, he's about fed up. Now he calls, he gets a ham radio operator that had flown in later that morning, and he gets him to contact his friend Bob Magnuson. Bob Magnuson flies up into the pass and kills two caribou, and takes enough to where he can't be nailed for wanton waste, and marks the rest with a big tripod for Wilmarth. So Wilmarth and one that was traveling with him at the time, Johnny Coffin, fed caribou all the way to McGrath. The guys that went out on the first Iditarod were prepared to hunt their way across the state if they had to. After the first run, if you carried a firearm, it was to ward off a truculent moose that was contesting the trail. But on the first race, it was to find food. At one point where maybe the greatest snowstorm to ever hit the Iditarod hit out there and just buried the trail, buried any markers that were put down by the Army team. And there was a civilian team that was supposed to stay 24 hours ahead of the lead, went out right ahead of the race after the Army team went about a week or 10 days before. And that civilian team finally just couldn't go. The snow machines couldn't float. And the dog teams caught up, and they all finally just got bogged down. They stamped out a great big sign in the snow, need food, but nobody could fly in this great snowstorm. When I got home and I read the account in the paper, Gordon Fowler had written that the drifts were 20 feet deep. Well, he wasn't out there. Made a good story. They weren't 20 feet deep, but they were really, really deep. They covered all the willows and things that out across the big flats. The only thing that they had to tie the markers to just covered them right up. So the guys are out there for two or three days with no food. And Dick Wilmarth and Bobby Vent both got out of Royal Beaver snares and prepared to go beaver trapping. Now, what person today thrown in that same situation would have the preparation to even know to include beaver snares in his load? These guys, like I said, these are quintessential old-time Alaskans. Seavey goes over to George Atla. There were four of them in that lead group. Seavey, this is Dan Seavey, grandfather of Dallas, father of Mitch. He reasoned before the race that probably small game was the more likely way to subsist. George Atla, though, had a big game rifle and was thinking in bigger terms. So Seavey goes over to Atla and says, George, let's go back and get that moose that we passed a couple of days ago in this snow. He's not going anywhere. He'll be right there. He says, I'll be your packer. Dan Seavey was ready. George got out these wonderful hand-built snowshoes that his brother Bob handcrafted. Just finished donning his snowshoes. The guys were just straightening up to take off, and a plane found a hole in the clouds and came down and dropped a couple bags of dog food and then flew and signaled him the way the trail went. He could see ahead far enough to see where it went into a patch of timber, I think, and got the guys out of that pickle and going again.
I did a ride trail.
Tales of the First Iditarod with Rod Perry. And welcome back to the Big Alaska Show. I'm Mike Ford with Uncle Steve. Our show brought to you in part by Neighbors Windows and Doors. They're Alaska's window experts for windows, doors, shower doors, affordable glass replacement. Neighbors Windows and Doors at 6251 Tunnel or online anytime at neighborswindowsanddoors.com.
Thanks for joining us on the Big Alaska Show. Uncle Steve, along with my good buddy co-host Mike Ford, we've been listening to an interview with Rod Perry talking about the 1973 Iditarod. I want to remind you, if you miss our broadcast, we have podcast at BigAlaskaShow.com, sans commercials, for the most part. Here's our part three with Rod Perry.
Let's continue our conversation about the first Iditarod with Rod Perry.
It was a more primitive race, for sure. One thing about it is called the big camping trip. A lot of guys call it the big camping trip. And you'll see the new guys chuckle about it, or guys that really don't know, it's like we were lollygagging our way around. That wasn't it at all. It was that there were about 15 effective checkpoints. There were a few more that were hardly effective. They didn't do much for you. I don't mean when I say do much for you that they were serving you as far as completing tasks, but just that, maybe it wasn't really a food drop place you could drop a dog. And one guy out there, a state employee that was romancing one of the checkers that was flown out, he wouldn't even get out of bed and come and open the door. He just called to us out the window. So it took me 30 days to reach Nome on the first Iditarod. It took the tail-end guy a little short of 5 weeks. So we had to camp a lot. If there's 15 checkpoints, it takes me 30 days. Obviously, that's an average of one every 2 days. Today, the guys are doing in about 7 and change running days what we were doing, what the tail-ender took, in our race, took almost 5 weeks to do. There's getting up toward 24 checkpoints. The guys are whipping through about 3 a day. So you don't have to camp. One fellow recently told me he hadn't had his sleeping bag out of his sled for the last 5 or 6 races. We camped a lot. And it was after the race got quite a ways ahead of the middle of the pack, it was a slog a lot of the ways. Every day you're breaking your own trail. Now, here's the way I've explained it to people. Most people don't understand dogs, but they understand horses pretty well. Think about a hypothetical great horse race held 200 years ago. People come from all over the earth. Maybe it takes a year to get the word out, a year to gather, and they're finally gathered. And, of course, back in the day when a lot of people died within 25 miles of where they were born and never traveled any farther than that, they didn't know to go somewhere else to get a different horse. They just brought what they had. So the gun goes off. It's pretty predictable what that race would look like. Way back in the back is the little Israeli with his donkey and the English farmer with his 20-hand tall shire just plodding along, and they look into the distance past all of the Shetland ponies, Icelandic ponies, Morgans and quarter horses and everything else. Over the horizon go the Sheik on his Arabian and the Comanche on his Mustang. And these guys back in the back look at each other and they go, holy smoke, we need some of those. Well, give them 45 years of holding that race, they're all going to have, quote, some of those. And it starts to equal things and bunch the pack like you see today. Back in the day, it was more like everybody bought their own type of pony. And so the race immediately spread out over hundreds of miles. There was no way for one race marshal and one veterinarian and one guy sent out to work communications to keep track of the whole thing. Two guys broke a runner. They were on a double team. The first year, you could have two to a sled, and there were three double teams out there. And the communication was so slight, I'll break away from the double team for a minute. One guy got into the race without paying an entry fee and without sending 1 ounce of supplies out onto the trail. He made it as far as McGrath, just picking up scraps, but he got into the race. That's how things could drop through the cracks. Communications weren't very good, and one of the double teams somehow didn't get word that there was such a thing as checkpoints and food drops. And so they thought you had to carry everything all the way. At least I think they figured they would have to carry everything that it would take them to get to McGrath till they could get there. And, of course, there's jet service into McGrath, jet service into Galena, jet service into Unalakleet, and you could have some big piles sent there. But these guys had a mountainous load, plus both being really big guys. They combined teams, and about the first day out of Connect, around Susitna Station, they broke a runner. Holy smoke. Please, Lord, anything. Don't let me break a runner. They broke a runner. So they're trying to fix it. A huge snowstorm came, obliterated the trail. There was no way they could find it. They struggled and struggled to find the trail. Finally, Ford left Mike on the river at a fire, and they left him with one dog, his dog Leadbottom. Went off in search for food. He was gone into the second day. He found a cabin, and he found a bag of rice in there. I mean, I don't know who would leave a bag of rice for the shrews and mice to get into, but he found this bag of rice, and I mean, it was a big bag, 50 pounds or whatever, and he dutifully, painstakingly cooked it up pot by pot and froze it. He came back, found Mike at the bottom of about an 8-foot hole. First, he couldn't see him at all. Where did he go? And then he saw the smoke coming up out of the snow and downriver, and there was Mike looking pretty forlorn down there, and he was really ticked off at Leadbottom, wouldn't curl up with him to help him stay warm or anything. The fire had melted the snow down. They battled their way back out of the Alaska Range. The trail was so obliterated, they didn't even come out where they'd gone in. They had gone in at Kinnick. They came out at Lake Lucille in Wasilla. People said, "Who are you?" "Well, we're Ford Reeves and Mike Schieber with the Iditarod." "What?" And the race managers and anybody that was working and staging the race had no clue. They'd been gone from the race for maybe 8 days. Think about it today with all the electronic hand-holding, I call it, and how you would know in 5 seconds. And that there'd be sent someone to rescue them. The race would stretch out. You know, you've got the Morgan horse, and you can't catch the guy on the thoroughbred. And the guy back in back of you with the Icelandic pony can't catch you. And so the race just stretches out and out. The longer it goes, the farther between mushers. So the wind comes along and fills the trail up. Now it's knee-deep. You're out there on webs ahead of the dogs breaking trail. But if it has blown and filled the trail, well, when it blows and fills the trail up, you can always see these little edges, and you know where the trail goes, so you're not going to lose it. People ask, "Well, didn't you have a compass?" What good does a compass do? You know, the trail winds this way and that. Yeah, you might be able to figure out pretty close to where you are and set a compass course to the next checkpoint, but maybe the trail doesn't even go. I mean, it won't go straight. And so you're out there making your own trail, when if you just were able to stay to the trail and take all of its winds, you would get there way, way faster, because you're going over a cleared route, at least, with a trail bottom down there instead of it being up to your neck. So you've got to stay to the trail. If the snow blows the trail full and then it snows gently down out over that, it hides it completely. And you dare not be on snowshoes that float, because you won't be able to feel the trail. You can't see the trail. Got to go by one of your other senses. It's going to be feel. So the snowshoes stay in the sled, get out in front, waiting. And you're going along maybe to the top of your knees, waiting, waiting, waiting. The dog's following you. And all of a sudden, you're down with your left foot up to your hip. Or maybe you fall clear over, the snow's so deep. Well, you know, you you went slightly off to your left. You climb back up onto the trail and keep wading along. I'll tell you, you're going maybe a quarter, half a mile an hour sometimes, where the guys up front of you are trotting at 6 or 7, and the distance keeps widening. And by the time the guys in back of you get to that point, well, it's been another day or so, and they're doing the same thing. So when they talk about the big camping trip, that's really what it was all about.
I did a ride trail.
This is Uncle Steve, and you've been listening to our special Iditarod edition of the Big Alaska Show. Listening to Rod Perry's account of the first Iditarod in 1973, one can't help but feel that race would fit in today's extreme sports category. Things certainly have changed since those days. What used to take weeks now only takes days, even for the Red Lantern winner, the last mushered across the Burled Arch in Nome. But we are fortunate to have been able to sit down with Rod Perry to hear firsthand his tales of the very first Iditarod in 1973. Although today's Iditarod is more streamlined and more corporate, it still is more popular than ever to the rest of the world. And for us Alaskans, it's the opportunity to honor our Iditarod community and remember the legacy of the men and women who started it and have continued that tradition that can only be found in the land of the last frontier. Of course, it wouldn't be the Big Alaska Show if we didn't play one of our all-time favorite games called
Tall Alaskan Tales, Tall Alaskan Tales. No good lying through your tooth, Tall Alaskan Tales.
Here we go.
The Iditarod has a remarkable history of Alaskan folklore. But perhaps one of the most remarkable lives of any associated with the Iditarod has to be that of Colonel Norman D. Vaughn. Vaughn was born on December 19, 1905 in Salem, Massachusetts, and lived to be over 100 years old. But he didn't come to Alaska until the age of 68. Bankrupt and divorced, he rebuilt his life, competing in 13 Iditarod races, and even crashing the presidential inauguration parade in 1977, bringing sled dogs to represent his adopted state. In 1997, he organized the annual Norman Vaughn Serum Run to commemorate the 1925 Serum Run to Nome, which saved the town from a diphtheria epidemic. But that was only part of his remarkable adventure. In 1928, Norman dropped out of Harvard when he heard that Admiral Richard E. Byrd was organizing an expedition to the Antarctica. Admiral Byrd accepted him on the 1928-1930 expedition, eventually naming a mountain on the continent in his honor. It was during this time Norman was at the Antarctica with a group doing research on the ice depth. They're extremely hungry and cold, virtually hypothermic, which can be a life-threatening condition. They only had a little bit of steak, which would certainly stave off the effects of hypothermia. The problem was one of their members was a Jesuit priest whose vows prohibited him from eating meat on Fridays. But in these dangerous conditions, the priest almost broke his vows until they remembered, wait a minute, we're at the South Pole. Took some coordinates, walked over 200 yards, which put them in the day before, whereupon they ate the meat. Is this the truth or no good lying through your tooth, Tall Alaska Tale?
Yeah. Yeah. I love it.
Yeah.
I'm going to say that was true, Uncle Steve.
So, that's our show. Oh, by the way, you'll have to tune in next week to hear the answer for our Tall Alaska Tale. But you can email us at bigalaskashow.com and tell us what you think. The Fur Rondi, the Iditarod, two Alaskan events that bring people together and celebrate what our show is all about, the big Alaskan spirit. Regardless of situation, Alaskans rise and make it happen. And to my baby girl, love you, and Mike Ford, why don't you take us out as you so eloquently do?
All right, Uncle Steve, we want to thank our guests, David Rod, Lord Trapper, and Beth for joining us. We want to thank you for listening. And we want to thank our sponsors, Neighbors Windows and Doors, Alaska's Window Experts at 6251 Tunnel, or online at neighborswindowsanddoors.com, and Big Alaska Show Blend, the intense early morning coffee to cut through the early morning fog. Visit bigalaskashowblend.com. Remember, if it's Big Alaska Guests, Big Alaska Adventures, and no good lying through your tooth, Tall Alaska Tales, it's got to be the Big Alaska Show.
Have a great week, everybody.